Thank you. And Judith, welcome to the Conversations on Buddha Nature. I think we have met and spent time together in Bumthang in Bhutan, I think 4 or 5 years ago, the wonderful retreat then. And it's a great, great pleasure to see you again and have this conversation. So what we have done with this forum is really in order to boost the impact of the Buddha Nature online resource that Sadhana Foundation has built, doing these kind of activities and events to promote the awareness of Buddha Nature and to have exchanges and insights or experiences in both study and practice of Buddha Nature. And I think the past year, this has become even more urgent and needed because all across the world, because of the pandemic, a lot of people are going through a great deal of stress and depression, a lot of negativity. There's almost loss of hope and optimism in many parts of the world. So it really helps to talk about basic human goodness, to have a positive outlook. And you are one of the people who have been promoting this kind of outlook and approaches even to make friends with death. I mean, death is seen as a horrible, terrifying thing by lots of people. And you have the expertise to make friends with death. So let alone, now let's not even talk about smaller problems. So you'd have plenty of wisdom experience to share on this. But before we dwell into Buddha Nature and how we can make Buddha Nature relevant to the contemporary problems we face, I would like to know how you came into this sort of role of yours, how did you encounter the teachings on Buddha Nature and Buddhism in general? If you can tell us a little bit about your own spiritual journey.
So like many people, I just encountered this tradition at a certain point in my life. In my case, I was living in New York City, and I had spent a year in India, but I wasn't searching for a teacher like many people in that time were searching in the East for some kind of wisdom. And I had gone more from a social perspective of economic development and social issues and that. And I came back to do graduate studies in sociology and Asian studies at Columbia. So I was there during a very tumultuous time in the late 60s. And through a number of circumstances, after I finished my coursework, I was supposed to go back to Asia and India as part of a research study to work on my doctoral dissertation. It was a cross-cultural study and someone was going to Mexico, I was supposed to go to India, and someone was going to Indonesia, et cetera. And what happened is when I was supposed to go in 1970, I guess it was, there was a war. India and Pakistan were engaged in a war, as they sometimes do. And U.S. gave fighter jets to Pakistan at the time, and India took away all the visas for people, scholars coming to study in India in retaliation, figuring that we were all spies. And so I was stuck in New York for a period of time. I had this grant and I had finished this coursework, and I was just sort of bopping around New York. I'd go to demonstrations and go to presentations by different teachers and whatnot. And I was just sort of hanging out, and as a young person getting paid to do nothing was pretty cool. Now, anyway, during that time, some friends of mine invited me to go to a talk, and it turns out to be one of Trungpa Rinpoche's students. So I went to that talk, and you know, I wasn't really totally drawn in, but then some friends of mine were going up to what was called the Tale of the Tiger, which is now called Karma Chilling, where first kind of landing spot for Trungpa Rinpoche in the US. So I just went up for a weekend with these friends with no expectations whatsoever. And that's when I was met Trungpa Rinpoche, and that's when I was introduced to sitting meditation. And that made a big impact on me. And over the course of the next period of time, Trungpa Rinpoche gave many teachings in New York City, and I would go to those. And gradually, I realized that what I really wanted to do was study the Dharma. So to the chagrin of my advisor at Columbia, I dropped out and I moved to Boulder to study Dharma. And that's how I began my studies with Trungpa Rinpoche.
Wonderful, wonderful. So when you studied with Trungpa Rinpoche, how often or how frequently would you study or deal with Buddha nature? Was Buddha nature part of the curriculum that you had to go through? Like, did you study something like the Ratnagotra Vibhaga? What kind of system did you have that exposed you to the concept and practice of Buddha nature?
Well, it's interesting because the view of Buddha nature and the approach of Buddha nature really was a stream throughout his teaching. Every teaching he did, it was a so important part of it, but he did not do it through the means of traditional text study. In fact, he had a way, especially in his early days of teaching, that he would introduce aspects of Buddhist view, traditional view, but he would not label it as such. So it sounded to a new student from like me, it just sounded like someone who knew everything. And then later, when I studied more of these materials, I could see where they came from in terms of everyone was so traditional, coming directly from the texts. But you could go through the whole thing and never read a whole text or even know any text existed, and you would be still covering the same material. He had a way of kind of a translating tradition, which I think was myself, I think was very brilliant and made it accessible in a way to a variety of people. And then within the students, people took many different paths, but at the central thing was a sense of basic goodness and a sense of human potential and the nature of awakened heart. In one of his early-ish books, The Heart of the Buddha, he says that's the whole heart of the whole thing. It is the fact that everyone, not just certain people or not certain types of people or not certain eras of time or even just human beings, that every living being has this essential nature, and that through practices such as meditation, you can get glimpses of this, and those can really carry you forward tremendously. And again, going back to your introduction, in these current times, there is so much distrust of human possibility and so much nihilism and kind of disappointment, and it's easy to lose that heart. There's so many examples we all have, both for, at least for myself individually and as a species, of acting harmfully and with great ignorance, and it can lead to a lot of despair. So being able to connect somehow with these teachings, even if it's just a view. We were always taught that there's a difference between what we're told and what we know and experience. And so even if we're just going from what we're told, having that view of when we look at another human, especially humans that are really difficult, to have somewhere in there a sense of Buddha nature is a radical kind of a thing. And then in terms of personal, how we lose our inspiration, and it's easy to say, this is ridiculous. Look at people. How could you say that they have Buddha nature? The meditation side is so incredibly important, so that at least to some degree, it's not just a conceptual thing, but it's within, That's.
I've not had the fortune of meeting Tungpo Rinpoche, but I've known many students of his, like yourself, and read some of his books. And of course, for a Himalayan person, he was extraordinary in terms of how he could convey the real message without having to use the sort of local jargon or the technical jargon, and also take it out of one cultural context and make it so relevant. I admire him for how he really reformulated a lot of the teachings in the idioms and the sort of educational ways that appealed so well and was so effective for audience in the West. You shared a quote with us in one of your emails earlier, and a quote from Tungpa Rinpoche, which goes, I quote, "Before any kind of perception occurs, wakefulness is already there, beyond concept, beyond limitation, beyond anything measurable. We can all awaken. That is the hope and the potential." Can you elaborate a bit on this? What I would like to know, and perhaps the audience would also like to know, is, was Tungpa Rinpoche seeing Buddha nature more as a potential or a sort of wakefulness or awakened state that is already latent in us, which we just have to reveal?
Yes, he spoke on that quite a bit, particularly in the Profound Treasury volumes, and he contrasted the two views of Buddha nature as a potential that we can somehow nurture and bring to life, and the view of a fully formed Buddha, total awakened quality. And his approach was the second. He said it's there, and you can't do anything to it. You can't make it better. You can't get rid of it. And then he talked, I think is quite traditional. Is it what it's all about? Removing layers of obfuscation or layers that cover up that nature. Mm. And he gave an interesting little story in the Heart of the Buddha article, where he said that sometimes when children are growing up and they have extraordinary qualities they're developing, but around them, their family says, no, you have to get a fit the norm. So there's a kind of a reducing or diminishing of things that stand out in some way, kind of burying our own potential, because the potential is actually a little overwhelming or scary to people. Mm-hmm. So he told this story of that experience of that some people describe as, you have to hide the qualities that are most essential. Sometimes you learn that growing up in education system, the things that would connect you with Buddha nature are a little disruptive to the conventional view. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's a funny story. Yes. I thought a different angle that I hadn't looked at for a while. But definitely in that image of a fully formed Buddha. And he also really pointed out that it's not just humans, which was really, humans have a lot of benefits in terms of, the qualities of abilities of human life. But he was definitely not just relating to humans. And I don't know if he's being extreme, but he said every living being, everyone, even little mosquitoes. That's something. There's some this inherent capacity to grow and to flourish at some deep level, apart from the trappings of success in the world, and that a person could look really very unconventional, like the Mahasiddhas.
So when you have these kind of teachings, which are extremely profound from, say, a Mahayana Buddhist point of view, But they can sound quite radical and provocative also. I think I remember sitting in a Zen retreat once in South India, and most of the attendants actually from Theravada Buddhist background. And yeah. Zen master just started by saying, "You are all Buddhas." And they just couldn't believe. They were all totally puzzled. So when you have teachings like the Buddha nature being latent in you with all the qualities of the Buddha, and then again, this proclamation that not only human beings, but all sentient beings, including mosquitoes, have Buddha nature. For a Western audience, when you deal with people, especially as a psychotherapist, now you mentioned earlier about problems of overcoming nihilism through such teachings, but then these teachings also could sort of lead people to think of some kind of an absolutist, eternalistic thinking, so to say. So mm-hmm. how one differentiate this with the theistic concept, or is there a difference anyway? I sometimes wonder if the Buddha nature actually refers also to the sort of very profound understanding of God in Christianity.
No,
so what's your take?
Well, yeah, that's a really great, because I think apart from the kind of radical notion that other sentient beings matter as well as us, there's also this critique, as gone back forever, of the Buddha nature just becomes like a god or theistic or ego oriented kind of thing, and it loses the emptiness teachings. And and the way Trungpa Rinpoche emphasized the foundational teachings, he's talked about it this way. He talked about he started his students very, very strongly on the foundation, just basic Buddhist foundations. And he said, and not only that, but within that, really spending time on samsara, really understanding how bad samsara is, how it operates, what perpetuates it, how seductive it is and whatnot, that all those kind of basic teachings, of desire and suffering and the Four Noble Truths, and also the pairing that with grounding people in shamatha, vipassana, and then going from there to really trying to emphasize a kind of emptiness teachings and with compassion teachings. And also he talked often as openness. He sometimes would use open ground as much as the word emptiness, because it was a less negative sounding space, of potential. And so that when he talked about Buddha nature, wisdom, that there was some protection factor from the groundedness and from a sense of things are not so solid and not holding to fixed views and habits. And then it's less apt to be taken as a either personal ego or ego that we project as a god. But this reminds me of a dialogue Trungpa Rinpoche had with this wonderful rabbi, Reb Zalman Schachter, and Buddhist Christian dialogues that were held at Naropa. And one of the great lines from that is when Trungpa Rinpoche had talking about non-theism and non-theistic approach. And at one point, Reb Zalman said, "I think I don't believe in the same God you don't believe in." So the sense of the notion of God is not so simple, as sometimes people make fun of. Non-theistic of God.
You mentioned the importance of foundation for Buddha nature teachings, and you yourself give quite a lot of emphasis on that in your books. So practices like compassion, or even practices of developing sort of dislike of samsara. How would you recommend people to blend that or connect that with Buddha nature? Do you see compassion as an expression of Buddha nature? And then you talk about the three features of compassion. One of which is openness, which I personally find very nice. It's a fantastic way of seeing of connecting Buddha nature to compassion through that openness. So in your practice and your teachings, so how do you directly connect the foundations to Buddha nature?
I think it's interesting. I would say that it's Buddha nature that allows one to face the sorrows of samsara, to be able to actually look at the obstacles with some kind of dispassion and with the intention to be of benefit to oneself and other beings. So I don't think it's like Buddha nature shows up later. I think it's there from the very beginning. So it's not separate from looking at the world and in the as it is and the struggles that we have and people have. But it's almost the instigator of the path. I think that people have some notion, or they wouldn't even be following a spiritual path. They have some notion right at the beginning of the fruition. Even if it's a small glimpse, why would you do any of this? You know, what would keep you going? And I think it's this is mixed things. People have a lot of fantasies and ideas, and positive and negative. We all do in practicing and studying. But I think the fundamental kind of what do you call the engine that keeps people going is these glimpses of something. We know there's something that we is there, and there's a kind of a longing to honor that in some way, I think. So I think it's permeates everything from my perspective. And interesting in that little quote at the that you from Trungpa Rinpoche that I put up. The other thing that he emphasized and went back from the very beginning, even when in terms of the conceptual understanding was all the standard Buddhist things. But in this sitting meditation practice, he put a lot of emphasis on what he called first thought, which is the same as that quote, that glimpses of Buddha nature come up through meditation practice in the form of that instant before busy mind, takes off. There are little gaps, he emphasizes, gaps and dissolving, moments of dissolve, where this little, that openness, that Buddha nature, that potential is kind of waving or something, you get a tiny glimpse of those also inspire people with the, I think it was the simplicity and the intimacy, because I think I tend to think there's something better out there that's not possibly could be good enough what's in here. So I have to go find it and import it somehow. So those little glimpses are, build, I don't know, confidence or keep them going. Like, well, maybe there is some. Maybe it isn't just a nice story. Maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes. No, I mean, I'm just thinking that sort of practice and experience that Trungpa Rinpoche taught and you are familiar with must also come, of course, from the Kagyu Nyingma background that he has come, right? With the ordinary consciousness, the Tamelgi Shepa being the glimpse of Buddha nature. Exactly. And you, in your book, Making Friends with Death, you mentioned how mindfulness is about dropping our preconceptions and reconnecting to that moment-to-moment experience of life, you said. So it's probably that very brief moment of direct experience of your nature, free from preoccupations. Am I right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, he also, it's interesting because he also talked about Buddha nature in terms of, on the one hand, it's just this wakefulness, which is indestructible. It's not created, it's not dissolved, it doesn't begin, it doesn't end, it's not your possession, it's not all that. And he said sometimes the glimpses come out through acts of tenderness towards others. So that's the other side. There's the meditation, the glimpses come up through those moments of you know, where the technique dissolves and it's an ordinary mind, but also in an interaction with one another. There's sometimes the tenderness also draws you out of preconceptions, preoccupations in a way. It's a different kind of gap, like a tenderness gap. So there's kind of an awake gap and a tenderness gap.
So in fact, we have tenderness as part of the topic for today's discussion. Can you tell us a little bit about what you exactly mean by tenderness? Is it empathy, or is it being very soft and mild? What do you mean by tenderness exactly?
That's a good question. I don't think it's the same as empathy exactly. I think it's just it's almost like the moment when we're drawn out of our own drama somehow, and someone else becomes more real for us, apart from, it's not like we have to feel love exactly, or we try to take care of them exactly, but there's this kind of impulse away from ego, I think. You know, because like I'm a terrible practitioner, and I most of the time I'm thinking about stuff that have to do with me. It's very, keeps me busy for a long time. But occasionally that, you know, I forget, and something or someone else becomes more important. You know, it's kind of a relief.
I'd like to come back to, after a break for Q&A with the audience, to your more recent work that you have posted on your website. I think you also shared some of this when you came to Bhutan and when we met some 4 years ago. But before we do that, Marcus, if there are any questions, let me also look on
the chat. Yes, there are a few questions from the audience. One question says, Chogyam Trungpa uses the term the genuine heart of sadness in his Shambhala teachings. Is this related?
Yes. in the same way that these teachings permeate his teachings in the Kagyu Nyingma background, he also created this stream, which he called the Shambhala, going to that tradition and how he interpreted that. And in the heart of that is, again, this kind of tenderness, a sense of vulnerability almost. Because I think another thing people would tend to think, oh, Buddha nature, then I'm just invulnerable. You know, I'm not just a Buddha, but I'm a golden Buddha and nothing can hurt me, you know. And in fact, it's almost the opposite, the being strong enough to be vulnerable. And he gets at that in different ways as well. Because I think a lot of us are fleeing from our vulnerability, you know, because because that is tenderness, and tenderness, you feel something.
In fact, one could say vulnerability is a sign of Buddha nature, I suppose, because in one of the texts, I think it is a Sangha who says, if you don't have Buddha nature, you won't actually get tired of suffering.
And you wouldn't notice the suffering of others. So in that all connects, you know, with being and you look at, you know, the situation so many of us face, and so many people struggling so deeply. It's just, how could it not? Yeah. But people, even the horrible situations, something comes across. There's some quality of love. There's some kind of connection. Sometimes it's distorted and warped, but there's something that is part of our nature that is so positive. And there are so many moments, simple moments, where it's like, ah, you know, there's a, you see a beautiful tree, or you just have a feeling, or something makes you smile.
I must actually share, it was the past year with lockdowns, you get a lot of time to reflect. And one of the things that I have enjoyed so much last summer, and I'm beginning to enjoy again this year, is looking at nature, the flower petals, the buzzing bees, the pebbles, the breeze. I mean, there's so much beauty around us if we really know how to appreciate it. So life has been actually very beautiful and fulfilling during lockdowns with all the time for reflection.
I think one, Trungpa Rinpoche also, he's talked about both bodhicitta and Buddha nature and that quality of love and tenderness and kindness. And he said that nothing would function without it. You know, it, society would not function. Even in our, you know, very often seemingly dysfunctional world, there's this stream of compassion and Buddha nature that that makes most people pretty decent to one another. And all the horrible things one could do, mostly we don't, you know, and there's still this, it's like the, almost like a binding factor of the world, you know. He sometimes presented it that way, which I don't know if that's traditional or not, but he just pointed out like, well, why do people keep going? You know, why do they care for each other at all? Why do you even care enough to be aggressive to one another? It still is a sign of somehow weird, but caring in a certain way.
There's another question about Lojong, about the connection about Lojong practice and whether or not that is a useful practice, bringing up Buddha nature and tenderness to the fore. Do you have any comment about that?
Yes, I think I love Lojong practice. I think it's totally profound, and it carries on both sides of the indestructible wakefulness and also the tenderness. So there's so many terms that kind of connect in different ways, about absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta, and that the absolute bodhicitta slogans are the first a few slogans, and they set that ground in many ways, in the sense of dropping down to what really a core basic experience, which is wakeful. And then the remaining like 50 slogans are all about how to work with the tenderness and how to cultivate in the midst of life and in midst of interaction, in the midst of just daily life, how to somehow have a way of always coming back to this point of tenderness and regard, and also how to cut through it and kind of chip away at how solid is our inclination to think me first, even if we don't say it so crudely underneath, there's still that going on. How to lessen the hold of alienation and ego fixation.
Well, whoever asked that question was almost reading my mind, because the slogans that you collected from the Lojong tradition. And by the way, if there's anyone in the audience who doesn't know the Tibetan word Lojong, it's a mind training tradition, you could say. I want to bring up two slogans that you have posted on your website, which I think are directly relevant to Buddha nature. So slogan number 3, examine the nature of unborn awareness. Mm-hmm. I suppose that is referring directly to the indestructible tenderness that you're talking about right now, isn't it, Judith?
Yeah, well, it starts with resting in nature, Valaya, the base of consciousness, and then, but not then taking that as yet another identity or platform for ego. So each of those, some of the slogans seem to me, I'm no expert, to relate to more the sitting practice, a sense of sitting practice can be liberating, but then you can get attached in a way that is not liberating. So you have to keep going deeper and going further. So recognizing that awareness is unborn, you know, that sense of unborn awareness, and that's getting to the sense of also comes up in sitting practice. Sometimes we feel we should be manufacturing something. You know, it's very, it's like I'm doing this practice and I'm supposed to make something happen. And that again is missing the unborn quality. You're not trying to make anything happen. You're trying to let something be that's already there. More of recognition than manufacturing project.
And that very beautifully actually connects to the next slogan I wanted to bring up, which is slogan number 5, which you translate as rest in the nature of alaya, the essence. Now, alaya here refers to kunshi, I suppose, the ground consciousness, isn't it? So resting in the nature.
Yeah, again, that's, Trungpa Rinpoche talks about alaya, ground alaya, as before what things split into self and other, in samsara and nirvana. He talks about these basic splits, I call it basic duality. And in some ways the path is has a sense of split between confusion and awakening and samsara and nirvana. And he talks about something much more fundamental than that, that is not biased and is not doesn't have that sense of journey trying to go from one, you know, from confusion to less confusion, but it's just there and so fundamentally. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. It's that, again, it's that unmanufactured, reliable, so to speak, nature of our inclination to awaken and to be vulnerable and tender and not caught in the push-pull. And it has to do with, I think so much I experience nowadays with so many people also don't, so many people don't feel worthy, you know, don't feel that they have a capacities to awaken, you know, and we put all sorts of kind of assumptions. If I was going to be awakened, I would have to do A, B, C, D, and I have to be this way, that way, that way, that way. And there's so many stories in the traditional analogies that you go looking for something, but you already have, and it takes you so much work going along the path and doing all these practices and studying, reading a million books and all that, to figure out that you didn't need to do that, that you that you were already there. And the sense of fruitional approach of the that I, as I understand it, that you start with a fruition from that perspective.
Indeed. I think one of the main reasons given for the Buddha nature teachings is to help people who are losing hope, who are hopeless. So this is the message, isn't it, out there, that not only you have the potential, in fact, you already have the fruition in you, so don't be discouraged or lose hope. Marcus, is there any question? Or...
Yes, there's another question about tenderness. How can we use tenderness so that it leads to liberation from false views and not the other way, I guess, not vice versa. False views, I guess, becoming connected to more false views somehow.
Do you mean how could tenderness lead to more false views? Is that what you're saying?
I just read the question. I'm not sure what I think they mean. How can we use tenderness so that it leads to liberation from false views, as opposed to it becoming another site where we get attached and have more false views?
Yeah, well, I think that's why this always presented as this pair, that if it just being tender without any emptiness without any awareness, then it becomes sentimental and get attached in so many ways. And if you have a lot of awareness but no love and tenderness, it's also is a false use, I suppose. You could say either way, if it's like a checks and balances or something, they need to be together. And I think that is what makes the difference myself, that there's so many ways we can be trapped in our feeling so super insightful, or being wanting to be as a credential, being such a loving, kind person, always helpful, blah, blah, blah. Nothing wrong with that, but it can be a very much of a trap of when it becomes our solid identity that we have to, you know, put on the show to demonstrate how vulnerable, kind, and nice we are. That's all that, not all that liberating. It's better than the opposite, but so much, you know, is Trungpa Rinpoche, one of his hallmark teachings is materialism and spiritual materialism. And no matter what we do, the whole point of how difficult it is to be a practitioner in different ways is how we co-opt pretty much anything. We can co-opt pretty much anything as a further credential, a further reinforcement of duality and estrangement, rather than as a liberating thing. So a lot of times I think just recognizing that moment when we take something for that purpose, then we can begin to do that a little less, but to be really aware of how that works and how quickly and easily it works. You know, they sometimes in another kind of emphasis of Trungpa Rinpoche was like stages of the path and going from one stage to another, and, you know, gradual step-by-step approach. And in some ways that what works at one stage can become a trap at the next stage. You know, what you need at one point in your practice life, I think it has to do with, then it becomes too solid and too much part of your ego realm, then you need something else some other feedback to make the next step. So it's kind of very living and vivid journey that way.
Yeah, it's a bit like that very popular Buddhist example of not carrying the boat after you've crossed the stream after you've crossed the stream. Some things are relevant only for a specific period. Now, I want to come back to the work we have done for palliative care and making friends with death. And you've been working with the Tibetan Book of Dead for many years. This is a very old book, so many centuries old, quite relevant to its local Himalayan context. And even today, I would say a lot of people use it. But when you apply the teachings from something like this, which comes from a very different culture, from a different time period, how relevant do you find it in terms of helping dying people in your world right now?
I think personally, I think some of the teachings within the Tibetan Book of the Dead are very relevant, but I do feel that just simply taking it as an ancient text and reading it to people is not that helpful at all, you know, in a Western context, for sure. And at one point, when Trungpa Rinpoche said that really the way to use it in the modern world is to understand it, try to understand it yourself, and be able to say some of the key points in your own words, you know, that can be heard, that are not viewed as an ancient Tibetan text, and to choose what to say based on the person that you're dealing with and their background and their circumstances. He also emphasized it in his approach to Tibetan Book of the Dead. He emphasized a lot the relevance, not just for dying, but very much in terms of dealing with the exactly what we're talking about, you know, the whole themes within the Bardo of Dharmata, for instance, of being so caught up in our usual emotional habitual patterns that we're actually more attached to those, even if the bright light of awakening is shining in us. We've run from that and go back, hide out in a more familiar territory, and we do that over and over again. So it's presented, it's almost like saying, okay, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is like putting like a magnifying glass, you know, trying to like a knock it on the head. There you are. You can actually do this. You could wake up. You could go that way. And we say, I'm not going there. And it's a very hopeful in the sense that there's endless opportunities being presented, but mostly we find them too threatening to really see clearly and to really feel purely, too threatening for us a lot of the time. And that makes it painfully clear in the way the book is structured. So he called it a map of the mind, or Vajrayana Abhidharma. He called it a map of the mind, how the mind works in any situation, and especially in situations of loss or of change, and death being obviously a big situation of loss or change. But he emphasized that we go through that running away from our own awareness over and over again, you know?
So I think I also get that point. A lot of the things that are described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, I think they are probably metaphors for a lot of psychological events, psychological fears and expectations. And we shouldn't probably see them as sort of, we shouldn't read them literally and see some reified Buddhas, whether they're peaceful or wrathful appearing to us, but they must be expressions of our own internal state of the mind. But when you deal with, when you take the relevant points, what would be a few relevant points that you effectively implement in palliative care or in counseling people who are dying?
What I try to emphasize is the quality of the power of the quality of being present with another person, especially if a person is suffering, it's very hard to be present. It can be physically present, but it's very hard to be really present.
Fully present.
And so many times people are, how to be with a person without trying to fix them or to give them advice or to do all those rules. Those roles that so often we come up with when we're anxious in the situation of pain. And so, so many dying people, it may be different, I'm sure it is in different cultures, but so many people feel alone. They feel they can't talk about what they're going through. They almost feel, so many situations I've been involved with, the dying person is trying to help the people around them. You know, they not the vice versa. That no one just, it's very really hard just to accept a situation, be in a situation without, so the person doesn't feel there's something wrong with them or they need to be fixed or there's something failing. In the West, often the death is viewed as a kind of a medical failure. And it is in some ways, but it's really taking out the humanity of the, can we be with one another, you know, in difficult times? And there are times when things can be fixed and there are many times they can't. Then what do we do? Do we just write the person off, or do we just get frantic? And
So one has to have a higher sense of acceptance, would you say? A kind of tenderness towards oneself as death approaches.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. What's evident to me is that people feel that, you know, that it's not all, it's often not about words and it's not about actions, but it's something that connects in a non-verbal, non-conceptual way that is supportive, and it creates kind of a healing quality in the environment. And by that healing quality, I don't mean that, you know, miraculously then suddenly it gets better, but there's a different kind of healing. It's it's really providing an embrace for people of a certain kind. That it's okay. They don't have to be scared. They don't have to have pretense and try to show how good they are, you know, or feel pressure to die in a certain way that we think is a good way or whatever. Because it's a common pattern that people, when they get ill and they're bombarded with advice, but they're not bombarded with listening, being heard, you know. So that's very powerful, actually. So simple. The simplest things are the most helpful, I found. But I'm sure there's many other ways.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Simple and powerful. I think, I hope the conversation has also been quite powerful for everyone who tuned in. We are already past 10 a.m. Mountain time and 10 p.m. Thimphu time. So I think we'll call it today, at least for me here. So it was a great pleasure and honor to have you talk about Buddha nature and many things. Thank you for joining us, and all the people who joined us from around the world. Thank you also for taking part. And then if you are interested to know more about Buddha nature, please do visit our website, buddhanature.org, and you will find a lot of information there, both ancient classical texts on Buddha nature and many commentaries, but also a lot of audiovisual teachings on Buddha nature. So with that, we hope we will be able to promote more tenderness, more enlightened, sort of awakened or wakefulness, as Trungpa Rinpoche would put it. So thank you very much, Judith. Thank you.
It's been an honor to talk with you and reconnect. Maybe we'll see again.
Yes, yeah. Hopefully, yes, in person someday. Let's hope.
That would be great. Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you, Sadra, people. Thank you, everybody, for taking time to have this good energy going into the swamp of things that come across the internet.
Okay, thank you
so much.
Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marcus. Yeah.